Call to order our DC Bar Board of Governors meeting for June 10th, 2024. And before we get started, I just want to make a few opening remarks and to welcome a couple guests that we have. Sedina Montani. Sedina is our new president elect. Please stand up.
Keep standing.
I want you to keep standing. Belinda Edwards Taylor, also a new Board of Governors member. Layla Baum, I think is right. And Ghaffar Chowdhury is our new lawyer, non-lawyer representative.
And
I think on the phone also Josh Miguel. Miguel is our new treasurer elect is there. I think Josh, are you there?
Yes, hello everyone.
And we also wanted to make sure that we will say talk later. Oh yeah, you can sit down. Sorry. Thank you guys so much for being here as our guests. We also have to say six goodbyes, and including seven with my own goodbye as our last Board of Governors meeting. But to Ellen, Sally, Fatima, Brian, and Janine, we will be saying more about that later at our reception, but we wanted to, also Diane, I forgot. I didn't mention you, right?
I'm not leaving.
I know, but you got reelected. And we yes. And for our goodbyes, we will share that with others later at our reception. But I also want to just thank you all for allowing me to be the president for this year, and I hope that it's been a great experience. I was saying, and I know the past presidents know this, but by the time you get to know what the bar is all about and get used to things, then your term is over. And so, I've really enjoyed it, and we'll talk about that more too. So for my president's report, I just wanted to say a few things. Just make sure. Here. Yes. So I guess we've done a lot since our last meeting. We've had the DC Bar Advice and Referral Clinic for our Board of Governors participated. And I want to thank all of you that joined us, Sean and I, that were there for that. And hopefully we'll continue to have Board of Governors days and representation at the Advice and Referral Clinic. We also had our judicial luncheon here at the DC Bar, which was, I think, the first time here at the bar. But first time in a while.
We stopped during the pandemic.
And that went really well. And many of you were here as well. We had our meeting of the National Center for State Courts took place. And there was a reception for Chief Judge Anna Blackburn Rigsby at the Cosmos Club. There was our candidates forum. The Washington Bar Association had its Law Day dinner. Sean and I were attending that. We had our Constitution in the classroom. Unfortunately, we had rain. I was really hoping for a much bigger turnout at our DC Lawyers Have Heart Run, but we had some people there, a lot of good attendance and good showing in spite of the rain. We had our DMV President's Panel, which was a unique opportunity for the presidents of the DC Bar, Maryland, and Virginia bars to speak. Thank you all for coming to that. We also had the Women's Bar Annual Meeting where we honored Ellen as Woman Lawyer of the Year. Thank you, Ellen, again, for everything. We had our Justice Stuart Potter Award Dinner where Janine Jackson was honored. I'm not sure if Janine is on the call, but on our phone virtually participating, but we want to give her a round of applause as well. We had our Washington Bar Association annual conference, and this morning Bob and I were able to participate in the Board of Judges meeting to round out the year for the judges as well. So I think that's all I have. Bob, I think I will. We'll go to our consent agenda. I need a motion to accept the consent agenda, which includes our draft minutes from the April 16th meeting. It's been moved and seconded that, we accept the items on the consent agenda. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Okay. And now we'll go to our treasurer's report.
All right. Good afternoon. I'm reporting on the financial results for the bar through March 2024. Revenue continues to run 3% more than budgeted. Expenditures are running 3% less than budgeted through the end of the third quarter of the fiscal year of 2024. Here are the key takeaways for the first 9 months of the fiscal year. The bar ended March with a surplus from operations of $1.3 million, which was better than what we budgeted by $1.7 million. Fun fact, we were exactly in the same position last year. Year to date, revenue was $31.8 million, which was more than budgeted by 3%, and expenses were $30.5 million, which was less than budgeted by 3%. We have higher than budgeted results for license fees due to more than expected reinstatement and late fees, and from on-demand access to the mandatory course in books and publications. We also had more than expected revenue from conference room rentals to external users and from communities dues. The increase in net assets of $3.1 million is the result of the $1.3 million surplus from operations, plus investment gains of $1.8 million, minus a net $63,000 in client security funds disbursements. License fee funded activities through the end of March show a surplus of $763,000, which was better than what we budgeted by $1.4 million. Expenses were less than budgeted, with a savings in professionals fees from reduced need for consultants projected and some savings related to the timing of the expense. We are also showing savings attributable to timing and IT license fees, staff development, and printing and copying. These savings may decrease as the year progresses and actual expenses catch up to what was budgeted. As mentioned earlier, we also had higher than budgeted revenue and license fees and on-demand access for the mandatory course. For non-license fee funded activities, communities had a surplus of $98,000 from operations, which was better than budgeted by $255,000. Communities revenues continue to do better than budget this year and over last year due to the popularity of the new value proposition, which allows unlimited communities for one price. Communities also recognize expense savings primarily in personnel vacancies. CLE had a deficit of $9,000 from operations, which was $28,000 worse than budgeted. Revenue was below budget by 9%. This is primarily due to the royalty sponsorship revenue, less than budget by $26,000. Cost savings in professional fees due to fewer presenters and the accreditation fees added to an overall expense savings of 4%. The consolidated CLE program, which includes the mandatory course and rules education, generated a surplus from operations of $461,000, which was $351,000 better than budgeted. Other non-license fee funded activities, which include certificates of good standing, royalties related to the member benefit affinity programs, and rentals of the conference center and the studio to outside clients, generated a surplus of $452,000 from operations, which was $67,000 more than what we budgeted. Overall revenues was better than expected by 11%, which includes $93,000 in studio revenue from outside clients and $96,000 related to the room rental for the July 2023 and February 2024 bar exams. IT consulting fees related to the implementation of the lawyer referral service are reflected in other non-license fee funded activities within professional fees. It caused an overage, but was mitigated by the positive performance in revenue along with personnel vacancy savings. We had $103 million in total assets. Our cash balance was $3.1 million, and our investment balance was $21.6 million at the end of March. Compared to the same time last year, our cash decreased by $1.2 million, and our investments increased by $6.1 million. As part of our investment strategy, we moved cash that had been sitting in our operating account into higher earning short-term investments to take advantage of the higher interest rate environment. Our investment portfolio has seen a 40% increase in value. The balance of our budget of our building's mortgage, which comes due in August 2037, was $48.6 million. And this concludes my report of the DC Bar's performance for the end of March 2024.
Right. Thank you, Alicia. Now I'll turn it over to Bob for our CEO report.
All right, folks. Well, license renewal began on May 1st. And with it, we opened registration for both the lawyer referral service and the new attorney well-being community. And things are going pretty well. Our renewals are ahead of where we were this time last year. So we are 8% in terms of numbers and the amount of money that we're bringing in, about 8% ahead timing-wise. Now, these folks are eventually going to have to renew their licenses one way or another. So we will eventually land the plane. But as in looking at where we are with communities, pro bono, and CLE, we're either exactly where we were last year or slightly ahead. So which nice to see is that the community's proposition that we put in place last year, one price for an unlimited number of communities, is holding fast and working well. So as you've heard from Angela, the pro bono center donations are currently just under $1 million from our members, which is terrific. The lawyer referral services I mentioned launched on May 1st. And so thus far, members have been able to sign up when they renew their licenses. Shortly, it's not up yet, the single.
The standalone, so don't forget.
Well, in the next week or so, members will be able to then go in even after license renewal and sign up for lawyer referral service, that contacting member services. As of today, we have registered 321 members in the lawyer referral service, which is great. Our target was to register 1% of active members. So that 321 members represents approximately 1% of the active members who have thus far registered, which is great. We have been tracking what they report as their practice size and practice area to get a sense of who these folks are. And interestingly enough, they come from a variety of practice areas, including employment, family, criminal, personal injury, intellectual property, which I found kind of interesting. And we have a number of subscribers from larger firms, not simply solos and small firms. In a few weeks, the subscribers will upload their personal information, their practice areas, their specialties, and the rest into the system. And shortly thereafter, we'll open up to the public to begin matching the potential clients with the lawyers with the right skill set. But in the meantime, we're engaged in a training program for the system so they can understand what potential client scenarios might be and how they will eventually get routed to the right lawyer or lawyers. And so we've come up with many, many, many creative scenarios and put them in the system with a bunch of hypothetical lawyers, not the actual subscribers yet, but hypothetical lawyers, to see how well the matching is done. Because sometimes a client might describe something that sounds like we're fighting over a house. It might sound like a real estate issue, but it's really a family law issue. So the system will help learn, even if those key words are not there, because most lawyer referral systems use either a human being to listen to whatever the issue is, then try to find the relevant lawyer, or they do very rudimentary keyword searches. This is going to be very different because it's going to try to understand what the problem is. It's going to take some learning. And while there'll be some trial and error in the beginning, but we'll help fine tune the system. The more people that we have in it, the more opportunity we have for better matches. Once there is a match, the lawyer will be notified that a match has taken place, but not given the client information. The client will get the names and contact information description of the lawyers, so that the client will then have the ability to go ahead and pick and choose who they want to contact to discuss their legal matter. And of course, we don't keep the underlying data about what's going on with their circumstances. So we're going to continue to educate our members about the lawyer referral service. We have a virtual town hall coming up later in the month. We've got a couple of videos going out to help explain what's going on. And of course, beginning in the fall, after we have the subscribers upload all their information, the system has been practicing for a while. And what we're doing, when I say practicing, we see what the match looks like. And then we have folks who have knowledge in the area to see whether that seems to be right, whether that could be a potential match for that client, getting feedback. And then in the fall, September or October or somewhere in there, we'll flip the switch publicly and we'll be doing a public facing campaign in order to get the word out that this is available. We described this to the Board of Judges this morning and they were very excited about that possibility. Questions? I know you, I'm seeing eyebrows going. So I know there are questions. Natalie?
First of all, it's a fantastic service. I'm not surprised people are interested in it. But how is the AI being trained on the scenarios themselves? Because you've got the input from the attorneys, and obviously they've got their biographical information, and I'm assuming those are particular prompts. But on the other side of the equation, with the unknown clients, unknown potential clients, how does that AI actually get trained to match?
Katarina, Idem and Katarina are the project managers on this, and this is Katarina's baby. The technology side is her baby.
So I'm usually loud enough that you can hear me, but if you don't, please raise your hand. So we're actually not training AI in legal matters.
We use a large language model that understands English or many other different languages, and what they do, they look at the similarities of the narrative of the attorneys with the narrative of the client. So they don't need to know that, you know, a certain case needs a certain kind of attorney, but they need to know that the description of the attorney looks a lot like what the client is describing, the issues of the client is describing. This will require, and that's why this will require some education for the attorneys on how to describe their services in such a way that the match actually can happen. So we use 1,024 parameters to define the concept in the description of the services of the attorneys. And we use the same number of parameters to describe the case of the clients. And then we do like a mathematical comparison in this space with 124 parameters to 1,024 parameters for the similar concept. So it's not, we're not training the AI in the legal matters. That would be unethical. We're not trying to replace attorneys. We are just using AI to compare A to B, well, A to C, A to D, etc. So that's how it works. And we're also making sure that the privacy and security, so we are not passing AI, for instance, any kind of identifiable information. We're just passing the cases, and all the information of the client is actually not passed an AI. So it's just a numeric identifier saying client 12345. That's what AI knows, and they can return the information.
Are you using potential client scenarios? So although you don't have clients now, are you using sort of, I guess, imaginary clients?
This is a fun pastime among the staff. We've been drafting these things for all, because we all come from various backgrounds. And so I could do this all day long. I mean, literally all day long.
Yeah. So actually, we had a lot of people, you know, pro bono has been providing cases actually come in. Our rec council, they keep track of these cases. Bob, from his experience as a small practice attorney, all sorts of cases, people coming up, you know, I even made a call to staff, say, hey, if you had your own case that you want to share, or if you saw something interesting in Law and Order, doesn't matter. They're just stuff that we need to see if the match is correct.
And business, a lot of business related stuff as well, because there were fair, and there are business attorneys in the mix, because that's another piece of this as well. Questions?
Should we attend the town hall? Can you send out information? Is that for?
No, it's for the membership. It's okay. Membership wide, so we'll send it out to everybody. Yeah. All right, moving on. In several years ago, the board adopted a DEI policy, which governs the activities of the bar, and it also adopted the Mansfield rule, which technically applies only to law firms, but we adopted it as well. And the Mansfield rule requires for hiring positions of significant leadership, the candidates that we interview, at least 30% of them fall into a protected class. And so we've adopted that rule. And each year we are required to report to the board on how we did in meeting that hiring goal. As you could see in your materials, we did in fact meet the goal. We met it not only for positions of significant leadership, we met it for every single position that we hired at the DC Bar and the DC Bar Pro Bono Center this past year, which has been consistent year over year over year with what we do. And it's really due to the great work and broad ranging recruiting efforts of the HR team that we have here, Latanya and her team, Sandra, Katina, as well as all the individual managers who play a role in this. You can also see in the snapshot diversity that gets self-reported by the staff members, the gender and ethnic diversity of the staff. We remain an incredibly diverse organization, which is terrific. Also in your materials, you see that there's a memo that summarizes how we as a staff did in meeting the goals that you set out for us at the beginning of the fiscal year. And we do this every year. You establish a dozen or so goals that reflect a wide range of activities, our relationship between the board and the staff, specific programs that you are interested in having us do and see whether we can succeed in doing, improving this, that, or the other thing. So you can see what they are. It's a 15-page memo, so you can see how we've done. But we did successfully land a lot of the things that you wanted us to. The lawyer referral service launched. The early career lawyer community had the beginnings of a robust series of programs. We expanded with the attorney wellness community. Practice 360, the tax conference, the youth law fair, the wellness summit, all the signature events went really well. And we have every expectation that the celebration of leadership and the president's reception will do the same. I don't want to go into the entire report, but one thing I do want to mention, because I will say that I've been the CEO now for 7 years, and this one thing always, I don't think it's enough oomph. And so I'm going to give it a little bit of oomph right now. And even though Marg Lorenzetti is not here, she is the architect of this. You have the details in the report, and you heard some from Alicia, but the financial performance of the bar is extraordinary. And it's extraordinary in and of itself because we do well. But as compared to other bars around the country, this just doesn't happen. And it happens because of the great work of the staff. Again, I'm going to put a lot of this on Marg and Matt because he runs operations. But again, as you heard, as of March, we are on an operations basis ahead by $1.3 million. I mean, I don't want to overpromise, but it's probably going to be closer to three by the time the year ends and we roll everything together. You know, on a $45 million budget, having a $3 million surplus is pretty darn good. And this doesn't, again, it doesn't come without work. And our investments are doing really well. I mean, everyone's investments have been doing better this year. So the bar's investments are doing well. But the thing, and Alicia touched on this briefly, but what Marg did in the beginning of the year is that she figured out that we have all this cash in June, July, and August, and then we spend it down during the course of the year. And she took it and, working with Truist, our bank, put in a whole bunch of different vehicles that would generate interest given the high interest rates over the course of the year. $271,000 in interest. All right, just to put this in like stark terms, that's $2.30 for each one of our members. So we raise license fees by 10 bucks for active members. It would have been 12.30 absent that, right? Again, that's an oversimplification, but that matters. Like, it really matters. Also, because we had more cash on hand, we made it, typically speaking, we get $32 million between May and October. And then we just spend it, right? We just keep spending. So typically speaking, by the time we get to April, like, the well is dry, like, we're done. But we have a $6 million line of credit, and we finish out the year, and then we get all this money, and we pay back the line of credit and the interest, and then we move on. This is the first time ever we didn't have to draw on the line of credit. So in addition to saving that, making the $271,000 in interest, by the way, the client security fund made, I don't know, $20,000 or $30,000 in interest as well. But besides that $271,000 in interest, we didn't have to pay another $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 in interest to borrow money for a month or two. So again, you have all this in your materials, but I think that it's worth saying because we've come to, and I know I'm guilty of this as anybody else. Okay, yeah, we had a great month. Oh yeah, we had a great quarter. We had a great year. This is a really good year for the bar. It's a really good year for the bar. And again, Mark, Karen is here now from finance, of course. The finance division as a whole does a fantastic job. We had another clean audit, 7 years in a row, completely clean audit. So again, I think the finance team and the staff as a whole, but particularly finance, deserves a round of applause for this. Okay, and so then the last thing is just a couple of pieces of information. I'm gonna sandbag Darren for a second. We've heard a lot recently about the vacancies in the Superior Court. There had been 13 vacant positions. Two were confirmed in the past week, 2 weeks. So that's great news. We'll keep our fingers crossed that we can squeak out a few more before the election silly season gets even sillier. But it would be great if we can get some more DC Superior Court judges confirmed. And then the last thing I'll leave you with is a commercial, a verbal commercial for CLE Abroad for the Netherlands.
Yes, indeed. So we are going back again to overseas because the first two were such great successes. And I measure success not just by the fact that it's a moneymaker for the bar, it's contributing to our surpluses now, but also because of the goodwill that it's generating. Both chiefs went with us to Portugal. Chief Anna went with us to Scotland. Word got around. They met with their counterparts over there. The DC Bar's reputation on a global scale now is being broadcast on podcasts from Scotland, Portugal. We had incredible DEIA programming in Portugal. With Salima, who was on the board, our chiefs were there, and the feedback we got was just amazing. And I think that we're going to have folks sign. They're already signing up to come to the Netherlands with us. We have three packages available. You'll see the sign upstairs, and we have the website. But we have three packages now. We worked really hard to be able to accommodate the period of time between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And so for folks who want to celebrate, we still have packages where you can join us. But I would say if you can possibly join us, everyone who's come along just says it was one of the best experiences they've ever had traveling, not just because of the places we went and the people we met, but the folks that we traveled with. So there's my invitation to all of you.
Thanks, Darren. And unless there are other questions, I am done with my report.
Thank you, Bob. Any other questions, comments, thoughts? Well, we're going to now, our timing is perfect. We're going to turn now to the report of our DC Commission on Judicial Disabilities and Tenure. And we have a couple of guests here first. Please. Yes, we'll get you some mics, Akhil.
Reach the point when it's really
Absolutely.
I'm the same way.
Judge, welcome. And we'd just like you all to perhaps introduce yourselves and then proceed with the report.
So, good afternoon. I'm very pleased and delighted to be addressing such a distinguished group of bar members. Thank you for the invitation. And I'm going to do a snapshot review of the functions, responsibilities, membership, and our recent activities for the DC Commission on Judicial Disabilities and Tenure. So let me first give you some brief introductions. I'm Colleen Colacotelli. I'm the chairperson, and I have been since 2021. I've been a commissioner since 2017. I'm the federal judiciary representative from the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. And the chief judge of our court is the one who appoints whoever is. We're not automatically a chair, but we are one of the representatives. And the commission itself decides who is going to be the chair, and that's voted on once a year. So let me introduce you to the other individuals that are here. You, of course, know Commissioner Amy Best, since she is your representative on the commission. She initially assumed the term of Janine Sanford, who is a longstanding commission member and the former chair, who sadly passed away in 2022. Ms. Best was reappointed then by the board and is in her first full term as a commissioner. Amy is a very significant contributor to the commission. I value her input tremendously, and I'm sure she'll be among the future leaders of the commission. I'm also introducing Executive Director Cheryl Bosarth to my right. She joined us after an extensive search that we went through in 2023. She comes with extensive operational and leadership experience, and we're delighted to have her join our leadership team. On to my left here is Special Counsel Amy Conway Hatcher, who was selected by the commission in 2018 and then really started her work in 2019. I have to say, Amy has been my right hand for many years and has provided critically important legal and strategic advice to the commission and its leaders. Not just sensitive matters regarding judges, but matters public, private, informal, formal, but on setting and achieving strategic modernization goals that the commission set some time ago, and while still staying true to our statutory mandates. And the commission's success navigating the many delicate issues we face, while also being responsible to our constituencies, is due in no small part to Amy's wise counsel and trusted advisory role that she serves. We've provided you, or will be providing you, with a PowerPoint slide that, and I'll just refer to a couple of pages as we go through, that has far more information relating to, you know, our membership functions and what we've been, some of the things that we've been doing. So let me start with just a very quick review of the membership. It's somewhat of an unusual commission in that the commissioners are all District of Columbia residents. They're from varied backgrounds. We're all appointed by different entities. So the entities have decided, just as you have decided on Amy Best, we have the mayor, we have the president. So we have different, and that's basically on slide three, you'll see who they are and who has appointed them. We're a very dynamic group, I must say. It's a lot of work, it's volunteer, and it's unpaid. Bill Lightfoot is the longest serving commissioner, and he was originally appointed in 2000 and still serves. Nikki Sirtu and I began our terms in 2017, as I said. The rest of the commissioners began their service in the last 4 years. So you can see who they are on slide three. Your appointees, and they're two. One is Vice Chairperson Diane Brenneman. She was appointed in 2021. She has also been an extraordinary member who has provided in recent years invaluable leadership along with our special counsel that have brought great changes and improvements for the commission, and which I'll talk about a little later. Diane could not be here today. She had a commitment with her family, but she sends her best wishes, and I'm sure all of you know her. So we meet monthly, and it's basically the whole afternoon, except for August. It's the second Wednesday of the month, so it's a set time, and everybody's expected to be there. I break from trials to show up for it. We meet in special or emergency sessions as needed, which happens from time to time, not all the time, but we are willing to do this. So what does the commission do? If you look at slide two, it gives you more information. Our focus is maintaining the very high standards of ethics and the professional conduct of our local DC courts, and the critically important role judges play in service to our community. We take our role very seriously to assure, and in some cases reassure, the public's confidence in the integrity, independence, and impartiality of judges and the judicial system. So, how do we do this? Each of the activities listed in the, your chart on slide 2 are tied to our mission and our statutory responsibilities. I plan on focusing on 2 key areas that will be of interest to you. I think the types of reviews, and these are the judicial performance reviews, as well as complaints and concerns, are the 2 areas. The types of reviews that we do regularly bring us in contact with the judges directly in our courts, not only the one we're reviewing, but other judges that we speak to. So we view this as a very positive thing. We have more contact, more interactions with those on the court. So judicial performance reviews and complaints concerns. So this is the judicial performance reviews, and this would be of both active as well as senior judges. And the review can be the form of the term based and related to reappointments or initial senior judge appointments. We sometimes have midterm for medical or other concern is brought to our attention. We also do periodic follow-ups of your DC bar evaluations by the DC Bar Judicial Evaluation Committee. So we consider those sort of the 3 areas. Let me share a little bit more about term-based performance reviews and the periodic reviews through the DC Bar Evaluation Forms. So let me start with the initial senior judge appointments. The fitness review process for reappointments, and these are the active judges, and then we have the senior judge appointments, and they're described in more detail in our rules and our statute as to what the expectations are. So each judge that is up for a review submits a request and materials for us to review in terms of why they should be reappointed or appointed. The commission then seeks comments and input from the public, the bar, and the court itself. And a commissioner is assigned to conduct a review of each judge's performance and writes a report, a full report with recommendations to the full commission. The commission then meets with the judge, goes over, what information we have. There may be additional information we want. The commission makes a decision. It has to be all of the commission and all of us vote. And we write a report to the president if it's an active judge, or the chief judge for senior judges. Now, what you may not realize is that commissioners proactively interview members of the court, court staff, institutional litigants, members of the bar. We're working hard with our new executive director. She's helping us further increase our outreach during this process in coming years, particularly now that we've moved out of straight paper and are now digitizing our records. At times, these constituents may confidentially reach out to a commissioner or a special counsel to bring information to our attention. So it doesn't have to be they're filing, at something electronic with the office. Or they, of course, can reach out to any of the commissioners, special counsel. They can reach out to me. And we can hear from lawyers directly or through our main office. And of course, Ms. Bozart, who's at the office, will be able to handle those. We meet with the judge. We provide feedback. Some cases, they may include providing constructive feedback, setting expectations or improvements for the future. In rare cases, unfortunately, the commission can decide not to support a judge's reappointment. The performance reviews are quite comprehensive, and we value all input, and we're making efforts to get as much input as we possibly can. The number of reviews per year are all dependent on the judicial term, so they come up at different times in different years. So for instance, in FY23, we had 3 active associate judge reappointments and reports to the president. This year, we had none. Next year, we'll have 3. Now, also in FY23, we had 10 senior fitness reviews. This year, we actually have a heavier docket due to the number of seniors renewing and also retiring judges who've requested to continue their service, but as senior judges. And I'm going to pass this to Amy. We have two Amy, so it'll be Commissioner Amy and Council Amy. But Commissioner Amy, I've asked her to tell you, she recently did a report. So she went through the whole process, and I'm going to let her talk to you.
Thank you, Judge. So it's a very involved process. As you can appreciate, most of the work that we do is actually done outside of the committee meetings. It's much like the Board of Governors, as I recall from serving two terms in this august body, that you do a lot of work on committees, you do a lot of work outside of the meeting. But we interview as many different people with diverse perspectives as we can about the judge. So the most recent case that I wrote a report on, the judge was already in senior status. So we interviewed a variety of assistants who support the Office of Senior Judges. And they are a group of secretaries, essentially, and support staff who work with all of the senior judges. And they had all kinds of really interesting information to share about the judge. All of it happened to be extremely favorable, but it was really important to really get a sense of how the judge interacts with support staff in the court, because that, you know, as everyone can appreciate, it's not just the litigants that and the attorneys in the courtroom that the judges are impacting. They're also obviously interacting with the public. They're interacting with court staff. And so getting the feedback from the court staff was really, really important in this particular case. We also look at the appellate record of the judge. Has the judge been reversed on appeal? We look at our own complaint history in terms of whether or not we've received complaints about this judge in the past and how those have been handled by the commission. We talk to other judges. In this particular case, I talked to other judges who interacted with this particular senior judge, all of whom had incredibly favorable feedback about the judge and how important the judge was in terms of supporting existing associate judges who are incredibly overworked right now. There's a lot of vacancies on the court, as everyone can appreciate. And so the senior judges are critical to the operation of the courthouse. And so we talked to other judges in terms of their feedback, both historical when the judge was an associate judge, as well as his service as senior status. And then importantly, we also talked to the chief judge about the contributions that the senior judge has been making and his or her continued role, prospective role as a senior judge, and how important that role will be to the administration of justice, that from the perspective of the chief judge. And then as Judge Catelli said, we also invite the judge to come for an interview at our meeting, and we interview them at length about why they want to serve in the role, either as in renewed status as associate judge or in senior status. And we learn an awful lot about their objectives and their goals and what they actually aspire to do in their next term as a senior judge. So all of those pieces were critical to the report that we wrote and submitted. The judge was unanimously affirmed by the committee, of course. But it's a great process. And it I can tell you from my own experience, not having known anything about this this work that is done by the commission before I took the role as commissioner, it is a very, very thoughtful, very thorough, very careful process. And so it should give all of you great confidence that the judges that sit in the DC Superior Court, the DC Court of Appeals, are extremely well qualified, are working incredibly hard. And if things go wrong along the way, and those issues come to the attention of the commission, we are on top of it. We are very, very, very thoughtful about our work and take this job extremely seriously. So it's a joy to be here. And thank you again for the confidence that you've shown in me to appoint me to the commission. I've enjoyed it very, very much.
So it is a working commission. It doesn't just show up on, for our meetings. You really need to have work. And we take turns in terms of doing these reports. So, in a year, you're going to do a fair number of reports individually. Ms. Bozarth gives us support in terms of what is in the office in terms of complaints or other materials that we have sort of in the past, in addition to whatever new material we're getting. So let me, the other ways that we can assess and consider the performance is the DC bar evaluations. And I do want to put a plug in here for this. Years ago, the commission collaborated with the DC bar to gather periodic midterm assessments of judges from the public. This is done, as you know, anonymously, but participants are always invited to contact us about specific cases or issues that come up, or occasionally we can reach out if we can figure out who has written something. The DC Bar Judicial Evaluation Committee does an outstanding job of developing and disseminating these evaluations to the bar, and I learned more about it recently by having a meeting with your chair, who's terrific, just last year, and there was an article that came out that was publicized, and it was publicized along with the announcements for this year's reviews with the hope that, you know, we'd get even more people to put it in. It's useful for us to look at trends and concerns that people think. I mean, you're going to have people that are annoyed about one particular, you know, something that happened, but if you begin to see trends or concerns, we pay attention to that. So the more people that, you know, take the time to send it in, the more important it is. Now, while anonymous evaluations have their limitations, they certainly can provide an important snapshot of how the judge is doing, or importantly, how the public perceives that particular judge. It can also lead to important conversations with judges that allow for reflection and improvement, since they also get a copy, obviously, of this. It can provide also an opportunity for judges as to what they're doing well. So it's not only, you know, what people are unhappy about or complaining about, but it also tells them things that they're doing well or perceived as doing well. And that's important as well in terms of doing it. And as I indicated, it helps the commission to look at whether there's a pattern of concerns, either in this or when we look back at other evaluations, which we do, to see if there's patterns that we need to address or have the judge address. So the takeaways, the commission reads these reviews carefully each year. We get them, we go through them, we discuss them, we take a look as to whether we want to invite certain judges to come and talk to us. We act on them as appropriate if they raise concerns for us. We also use them, as Commissioner Bess has indicated, during performance reviews or in reviewing public concerns as we look for these. I'm going to ask our legal counsel, Amy, if she wants to add anything to this.
No, the bar evaluations, you know, are also used in the context of complaints. So if there's a serious complaint that comes in, we will pull old historical DC bar evaluations, again, to look for trends or patterns and to see if the commission has had repeated contact with the judge over the same issue. So the evaluations have actually proved to be quite helpful.
Okay, so let me move to the next topic, which is complaints or concerns that are raised. So how are they reported? We hear about concerns through different channels, both formally and informally. Obviously, the formal process for reporting them is most visible is the online complaint system, which a couple of years ago decided to improve the system to make it more user-friendly and also to improve our back-end processing, review, tracking, analysis capabilities. And this has been a significant project moving forward. We've also been able to, last year, Vice Chairperson Diane Brenneman and Council Amy led a soft launch of our new system. And then more recently, in December of 2023, Cheryl Bosworth led the hard launch of that new system. So it's in terms of electronic, and it's an easier way of basically getting complaints. People don't have to, you know, handwrite letters, et cetera, to it. But we also have other ways of getting an informal process for reporting it. They can be through discussions with members of the bar. We get phone calls. The public institutional litigants contact us. The court itself, or even court employees we've heard information from. These reports can go to the office, our commission office, but they can also come through individual commissioners or directly to me or any of the other staff. The informal notification can also occur if there's media attention on a particular issue. Occasionally there has been, that's brought to our attention some issue with a particular judge. So we look at every concern that comes in. Where appropriate, it will have a formal or informal discussion with the judge. And these things that come in, we deal with in our monthly meetings, or if there's a reason to do something more promptly, we will send something out and have a discussion in the meantime. So options for discipline or remediation, obviously the public one, which is mostly by statute, removal, suspension, involuntary retirement. A public censure does require the judges that's at issue their agreement by statute. Private, wide range of options. We can do letters, apologies, monitoring, self-reflection. These sit in our files and reporting back, setting expectations. So we do have, even if it's a non-public private, it sits in our file relating to that particular judge, which is there when we look at reappointments or when there are other, occasionally the JNC may want to know, have some information relating to if people are moving into other positions within the hierarchy. If there's a trend, a matter of important public interest, then we've issued what we call public statements, where we have not identified the judge, but it's we've noticed this is an issue that's coming up with several the judges. So we've had public statements about reporting misconduct that we put up on our website and other places. And they usually relate to the obligation of judges to report disability or impairments. They're supposed to report their own, but the other judges are also have an obligation to report it when it comes to their attention. And that we've been working on in terms of making sure that they understand that it's important. And these things are done as confidentially as possible. Also, just the ethical responsibilities to respond to judicial other judges that comes to your attention, some misconduct, or frankly, lawyer misconduct in terms of their having an obligation. These are areas that I don't think have been focused on necessarily in the past by the commission, but we're trying to do more in that area. And we've tried to put out public statements that get people's attention. Ex parte communications was another one that we put out as a public statement. We seem to found a sort of a trend of having more of that and more complaints to it. We did do a letter to the court on technical issues with the court's new case management system. Probably wondering why. Well, it has potential impact it could have on the performance standards, both delays and frustrations that affect the efficient functions of the court. Those of you that have used it or have tried to file things certainly probably have some firsthand knowledge of some glitches and problems that they're working through. But our feeling was that it was important to try and keep being informed because it does affect how the judges operate in terms of they're getting to information that's delayed or there are also demeanor issues in terms of frustrating that they can't get the information they need when they're on the bench trying to work things through. So what happens? How do we review? I'll give a few sort of statistics. We're just working on that. The majority of the complaints, 70% or higher, frankly, raise legal or procedural issues that are not within the commission's statutory authority. We're not the appellate court. You still have to go through them, make sure that, you know, there's not demeanor things stuck in the rest of the complaint. Conduct concerns, these relate to the judge's behavior inside or outside the courtroom, and that's basically most of the focus. We listen to audio files, review court records, submissions by the complainant. Sometimes we will have discussions with various individuals who would be aware of the complaint and might provide some context. Many are easy to dispose of once you hear the audio files. We get transcripts as well, but the audio files are particularly important because you could hear the tone and whatever is happening. Both with the judge as well as who's ever in front of them, whether it's, you know, a party, a witness, or, you know, or the other lawyer. In highly contested or emotional proceedings, a person's perceptions of how they're feeling may not align with the audio. Or in some instances, the litigant's conduct is the one that stands out and creates some issues. If conduct issues are noted, however, from our perspective, then we consider them very carefully and move forward to doing it. Our efforts on public outreach and facilitating access to the commission, I think has been working. We're getting more information from a larger group of people that are out in the community, which is obviously the goal. So last fiscal year, we reported a total of 130 complaints or conduct concerns that were actually reviewed. In this week's meeting, and we're having our meeting on Wednesday, the commission will review 53 complaints, 20 of which are in the DC, and then we get complaints about other courts and other judges and someplace else where we have no jurisdiction. We still have to review them. There are 33 that are at sea, and then we give them referrals as to where else they need to, who else they need to contact, if it's not going to be us. And let me talk a little bit about the strategic goals and plans. Before I get to that, let me pass it to Council Amy. Amy is the one who looks at all of this, listens to all the files, et cetera. And so we should give an example without telling you who it is. What you did with, say, a recent complaint in terms of, and I can think of several, where you had quite a bit of information to look at. So maybe give us an example.
I'll give you a short example because I know we're sort of short on time and going over on your agenda. But I get a call from a lawyer who might file a formal complaint on the system, but also they might know who I am and contact me directly and explain, that there was a judge who was sort of out of line, not really thoughtful in listening to the litigants, not letting them speak, making a decision, or being very gruff. So I will take the information. I'll get the information about the case in particular. I'll pull the docket sheet. I'll go to the audio files. I'll listen to it for myself and see what the context of the discussion was. If the there are times where the judges lose their temper. Everybody has a bad day. Sometimes more than one. And then there are instances where, you find out that the lawyers are really going at it and in a very difficult spot. And the judge did a great job of controlling the dynamics in the courtroom, but the perception of, how they were treated is a little bit different than when you're looking at it objectively. We can actually also go to a judge's courtroom and go online and watch just like everyone else can. And we do that occasionally. And then there are instances where, we'll hear from the public. Somebody from the public who's pro se in a family matter and is involved in a very, contested custody dispute, for example. Again, those are easy cases to pull and review and evaluate. And because I listen to so many audio files at this point, I have a pretty good sense of where things are going off the rails on either side. And it's raised some interesting discussions in the commission about the issue of civility, which I think you are all very concerned about. And the commission has really started to focus a lot on, both from the reports we've received from the community, but also from the judges themselves about this post-COVID era, where, lawyers are, we have a different generation of lawyers. We have different standards of conduct in the courtroom that aren't always respecting, the role that the lawyers are playing and the level of civility that they need to have within the courtroom. And then, we're also being very mindful of the impact on judges of shortages, the kinds of support they're receiving, the level of discourse, I would say, in society today that allow people to say just about anything. So it's a much more complex analysis than it used to be because there is so much information. And I think that's an area where the commission would also welcome further discussion with the bar. On the issue of civility, for all parties involved in the arena of the courtroom.
And besides not having all of the judges they need, although they did at least confirm two recent ones, they're still down. The caseloads are going up. So they're beginning with COVID, but also just generally, they have very heavy caseloads at this point. So it's a combination trying to get through, your cases, et cetera, and have these additional things. And the lack of civility just wastes time, frankly, in the speaking as a judge, in the courtroom, because you spend time trying to control it, or they're going off and talking about things that really have nothing to do with actually getting to the key issues and what you, need to have decided. So it is an area that we have an interest. But we didn't go through the
a little way over, so.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Then let me stop at this point and let you
and see if there are questions.
Yeah. The rest of it, you can look at our slides.
We're happy to provide additional.
Yeah, we can give. We also, it looks as if we with the city council, in terms of, because they do a combination of federal budget and local budget, we do appear and discuss at the city council as well. We do a report, and sometimes they want testimony, sometimes they don't. So the last report that we did is actually going to be uploaded, and we've been told that it can be made public. So we will make that available to you. That'll talk about a lot of the different things that you might have of interest that they've asked, and it covers the most recent activities, gives statistics, and some other aspects of it that I think might be useful. But if you all have questions, we're happy to answer.
Is your new or updated reporting or complaint system, is that, or can one make an anonymous complaint on that, or do you have to self-identify?
You can make an anonymous complaint. You can make an anonymous complaint.
Thank you.
Yeah, we're trying to keep that so people feel comfortable. They need to give us enough so we can go and figure the case out. If they don't give us the case or the number or something, occasionally we get complaints and they don't give any information. So there's no way of going and looking at dockets or anything else. We don't need names. We don't need who they are necessarily. We do get people that are in the gallery, you know, that are listening to it that are on Zoom or something and hear something and report it. So they're not actually, you know, one of the individuals in the case. And sometimes we do get them in the case, but sometimes not. So there's a variety of, you know, and we now with Zoom and some of these other things, you can get a wider reach, and we're trying to do that to make sure that as many people have something to say, that we, you know, hear about it so we can pursue it.
In terms of the types of complaints that you're getting, you said that you noticed an uptick in some of the complaints post-COVID. Are those mostly civility complaints?
I would put them more in demeanor or temperament, but others.
So I think there's always a range. I would say that the uptick in complaints is there's been a lot of effort to create greater access to the commission, and everybody has a phone now, you know, so now you can click on a link. And sometimes people get irritated about what happened in their case and they walk out of the courtroom and they click the link and they file something. So it's very easy to access. I think the goal was to increase access for the community to the commission. I think lawyers have always known that they could come there, some more than others. But I think the idea was increase access on the types of complaints. I would say there's more of the wide variety we've always had, but just more of each category, if that makes sense.
How do you determine? And I mean, you can't obviously do full-blown investigations for every single complaint that comes in. There just wouldn't be enough woman power to do that. But to that end, how do you decide sort of what might be a spurious complaint versus something that might have more meat to it?
You can usually tell. I mean, if somebody is filing something, you know, that's railing on the judge, and then they refile every pleading they ever filed in their case, you know, they're upset about the cases, right? They're not talking about the judge. If somebody provides a very specific recitation of the hearing and quotes the judge, and the language is, you know, is if that's really what happened, that wouldn't be appropriate. You know, that might be one you spend more time on it, go pull records. But I would say that it's pretty easy to spot things that are more spurious and the person's just really upset. And then we have frequent flyers, like every organization does, that, you know, people we know well.
You may know well.
But as Amy said before, 70% of them are jurisdictionally dismissed because they're really just, they just don't like the outcome of the judge's decision. And that's not something that we take up. So you can tell if that's what they're complaining about almost right out of the box.
They do get a response.
Yeah. Everyone gets a response.
Ignore them because they've given us, you know, decided we're the appellate court. We still give them a response so that they know that we've looked at it and, you know, why something hasn't happened. And we're working on our responses too. Be careful about, you know, what we say, but also to have them feel like we actually looked at it and there's a reason for, you know, not doing certain things or doing. And some things we do investigate and go further, but they are such that at least initially and maybe all the way through are not going to be made public because there's certain things that are we handle privately that are appropriate to handle that way, you know, with the judges. So they, we indicate we've reviewed it. We may not indicate if it's obviously a private resolution. We're not going to send that off in the public domain, but they do get a letter back. So everybody knows that we've done, you know, we've looked at it. We haven't ignored them. So, you know, they feel like they're, that we're being responsive to them.
And there are some that are public that are on the website,
right.
A number of them since I've been here, but you know, those are rarer, but they're important. So it's, you know, we do try to, where we can, where the statute allows, we do try to put some information out, but we're very limited unless the commission takes certain legal stances.
Well, and one of the things is that if you're doing a public censure, you do need the judge's agreement. So to have it be public. So that's another, you know, issue. And
I can just, we obviously have a good relationship between the Judicial Evaluation Committee and the commission. Are there other things that we could do to help you? Either get
the more information we get, the better. I mean, if you see things that you think are things that we should deal with or be aware of, some of it can be, we're trying not to get into micromanaging the court because that's not our job. On the other hand, such as their new case management system has created problems with, you know, the efficiency, which has created other issues in terms of delays and getting opinions. I mean, it's sort of like a domino effect. So that we did express some concerns. We're not telling them what to do or whether they should have it or not. That's not the issue, but we want to be informed and also make sure that, you know, to the extent that they can, that they resolve them quickly before, you know, so it doesn't have a cascade effect on other aspects of it.
Bob, the other thing I would say is that if anyone hears even anecdotally of concerns that are percolating that maybe haven't risen to the level of someone filing an official complaint with a commission, let us know. Sometimes we get that kind of information when we're doing the review for a reappointment or when we're interviewing another judge. And in the course of talking to that judge about how they feel about this judge who's up for reappointment or for senior status, we learn just of civility issues or of, you know, frankly, mental health challenges that the court is struggling with, both from litigants, counsel. I mean, a lot of these are post-pandemic issues generally. And they just float onto our radar screen so that we can be, you know, we can sort of have our ear to the ground. But anything that you want to share with us, we are open to.
And Bob, it might be helpful actually at some point for us to meet and talk, because I do think that there's probably more that can be done. I don't know that there's been that kind of meeting with the evaluation committee for a while. And I think it's very useful because some of the most helpful, I guess, calls in, you know, this happened where you get a phone call and you're like, people are whispering and talking and about a particular issue in this judge's courtroom. Those are things that I actually really do pay attention to, especially if it comes from a member of the bar. Sure.
The only other thing I would add is
if there's allegations of mental health issues, whether it's a senior judge or a junior judge or somebody's says that you seem to have dementia, or I don't. How do you evaluate? How does it?
We have a medical consultant.
Under the statute and the rules, the commission can require a judge to go through a midterm medical evaluation, and it's called the medical fitness review. So, if there are indicia of potential medical problems, obviously, you know, we'll check it out first and see what can be verified, either formally or informally, through sources that we have. But if the commission needs to find out information about something like that, they can order a midterm judicial medical evaluation, including with its own expert. And if, you know, those concerns are found in, the commission can work through the issues with the judge, either through, you know, a retirement or an involuntary return.
We're also not guessing. We do have someone who is a consultant medical person whom we can share information or the medical reviews to see if it's something that we should pursue. So it's not us deciding we're physicians. We basically have.
And sometimes we have our expert talk to the judge's physician or mental health provider so that the two experts are communicating with each other. And that's often very helpful.
I wanted to say that the other place that is helpful for us is in the routine. We post public comment periods. and for each of the reappointments and those things. And so it's very helpful to get that information in that routine cycle.
We'll definitely follow up after this.
That'd be great.
This Helen? One question you mentioned, I think, Judge, first of all, thank you so much for the amazing work that you all do. It's so important to our bar and to our community and to the public that our judges serve. Judge, you mentioned that at least for certain types of actions, you consult with the chief judge. And I just wondered, when in the process are you? Like, if you have to do an evaluation, a medical, or you're proposing that, like, how closely are you coordinating with the chief judges for, you know, whatever court that judge that you're looking at sits on?
I've been the chair since 2021, so it obviously depends on who's there as the chief judge. But certainly Anita Josie Herring has been very cooperative. We bring the chief judge in. When we bring the judge in to discuss their performance review, we also have the chief judge come and tell the commission, you know, their views as well. We will have spoken to them beforehand because the evaluation will include whatever their views are. So we will have some idea of it. But it's been helpful in the sense of it's very important to hear from the chief judge before things blow up. If, you know, that there are issues and that are going on in the court that the commission could be helpful, or we should be aware of it to be able to look into it. And these things can be shared with us. If you wait to sort of having it become a complaint, it is much harder to sort of work with the judges. And it also creates, you know, real problems for the litigants and the lawyers in the case. So we do communicate informally with phone calls. I probably talk to Anita once a week about something, but in terms of also getting information, we get information that, you know, they would not ordinarily give out. So I always make sure that we go through the chief judge to get this information. It's all very confidential kind of thing, but also just to have what's happening, what new programs they're putting into effect. One thing we're doing right now is we're having the presiding and deputy presiding of all of the divisions coming and giving us like a 15-minute review of what they're doing, what they do, et cetera. So not all of us have practiced or practice in Superior Court. We've got people that are not attorneys. And so they come, and that's been very interesting in terms of giving us one contact with them, although we will have spoken to them and probably somewhere along the line, but also to really hear what programs they're doing. The Superior Court's doing an enormous amount of programs, new things that are very interesting in terms of meeting certain needs, which I think are useful. So the contact is very important, and, you know, to see, for instance, are they getting behind? They get reports on motions, you know, in terms of what pending motions are, what decisions, those kinds of things. And those are sometimes helpful for us in terms of being able to see, do we have outliers? Is there a reason for this? You know, what's happening? But, you know, it's important for us to work well and have the chief judge be, you know, receptive to having discussions with us.
The one thing that I will say, because we're at a moment of
an important
moment in time where there's going to be a new chief judge selected. And one of the jobs that I've had over the last year and continuing is we have paper files going back to 1973 when the commission was created. And I'm going back through every file to figure out where there were formal, but also informal, private issues dealt with behind the scenes. And I will tell you that the commission's relationship with the chief judge has not always been great, right? There have been eras where there was a wonderful relationship with the chief judge, and then there have been eras where the walls are up and there's no discussion at all, which is not particularly helpful because it puts the commission in a position of having to get information formally as opposed to informally. So that relationship is super important, and it's been fascinating to see through history what that relationship has been and what's made it good or maybe not so good. So,
and also we're about to have a new chief judge. So we're hoping that whoever is selected also be as open to, you know, having discussions, understanding they have their role, and we don't tell them what to do or, you know, micromanage, but we also have a role, but that they're compatible and that we can be of help and assistance to each other. We have the same goal. you know, the best judiciary and serve to the community.
Well, thank you. Any other questions, thoughts, comments? Thank you all so much for a very...
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. So thank you for accommodating my time.
Okay, we will now move to the report of the Client Security Fund. Is that right? Sorry, the Governance Committee. I'm sorry, I'm getting my glasses. And Chris Glazer is on the virtually with us. Chris, yes. Are you there?
I am.
Okay.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Well, we'd like to, we're here to hear your report.
Okay. The Governance Committee over the last several months has been reviewing the existing DC Bar meeting policies and the governance policy for the Board of the Governors. The memo in your material summarizes the committee's work over the past several months. And during the past few months, as we were reviewing the meeting policies and the governance policy, we were able to meet also with bar leadership, various members, the past presidents, Jeffrey Kleinberg, Chad Sarchio, and Nancy Sylvester, our parliamentarian, who all provided very valuable insight. Without repeating the memo, I do want to highlight a couple of things. The committee determined that several policies were out of date. These were created for a bar and board that has since evolved since the inception of the bar decades ago. And with new Court of Appeals rules, with new bylaws, with new committee charters, a lot of the older policies were now repetitive and unnecessary. Two that I will highlight, the quorum requirement. While that was removed from the rules, the bylaws do provide for a quorum requirement that's in 3.09 of the bylaws, requiring that two-thirds of the members be present with the majority then present voting. In some, if they're appearing in the bylaws, there's no need to have a separate policy for that. Similarly, for the consent agenda that also appears in the bylaws, under the new bylaws 307, the CEO has the discretion in regard to retroactive reinstatement. And so providing a statement as to that policy in the meeting policy is just no longer necessary. So going through those policies, the governance policy and the meeting policies, pulling out a lot of the redundant, no longer necessary things, that gets us to attachment A to the memo. And in sum, we recommend the board approve it. If there's any questions.
Any questions, comments, suggestions, thoughts? Oh, go ahead, Ramya.
I have a question on the change. To me, what seemed like kind of the biggest or change was the elimination of the governance policy from 2019. And I was wondering if you can give maybe a little bit more on some parts may be obsolete or redundant because there are additional policies or changes that have happened since then. So to me, that's in a different category than we were making a substantive change, like this level of oversight that was previously there, we don't think is necessary anymore. And I was wondering if is there anything in the latter category? And if so, can you highlight that?
Sure. With various changes in the bylaws, there are a number of redundancies with the DC Bar budget policy, the procurement and contracting policy, committee charters. And so the idea is removing the governance policy to take care of some of those redundancies in those policies. Now, while it is going to be, or while it was recommended that the governance policy be removed, we do think that there is a need for a statement talking about the appropriateness of the CEO to further the bar's interests. environment, pushing an environment of transparency. But again, it's the idea of working together. I don't know if Bob wants to comment further on that or not.
Yeah, I think that the governance policy was really, most of it, the vast majority of it, just repeats pieces of either the rules or the bylaws or then existing policies. And part of it, I was a year and a half in as the CEO. And I think that the board was trying to set what the sort of the boundaries were in the overall relationship. Well, what's happened since then in the past 5 years is that each of those pieces, the financial management piece, the contracting piece, the relational piece, all fell into different categories. So the budget policy was revised and the procurement policy was revised. There was a CEO authority to do contracts up to a certain level. Sally may be the only board member who was here during that time period. And so a lot of that was put into one big sort of compendium, if you will. And what's happened since is that it's all been further defined. And so although the new governance manual, policies and procedures manual, has a statement about the relationship, as does the bylaws about what the role of the CEO is, the revised bylaws, everything seems to have been taken care of. And so the document itself was repetitive. It also was outdated in lots of ways. It contained a lot of things that were simply wrong as a factual matter and as a policy matter based on what has happened in the bar since. So it was a part of the massive cleanup effort to get rid of these really expired and obsolete policies. Thank you. I don't know if Sally wanted to weigh in as well.
No, I agree with that synopsis. That's my recollection.
Right. And just as a practical matter, we, in addition to going through the governance committee, all of the recommended changes went through the executive committee as well for a second set of eyes, as you could see from the memo. So we wanted to make sure there was plenty of thought that went into this to make sure we weren't missing something out of the governance policy or the other policies that we needed to address sort of as a total package, if you will.
Okay. On the issue of the waiver of the two meeting policy, that we need to vote on that, and then as well,
we could formally. But it's included in the agenda, so folks are on notice that they can vote on the governance committee's recommendation today.
So are there any other thoughts, questions, comments? So for this particular matter, the committee recommends that the board approve the proposed DC Bar Board of Governors policies and procedures, that's in attachment A, and repeal the DC Bar meeting policies, which was attachment B, and the DC Bar Board of Governors governance policy from attachment C. And you all can see that they've tried to condense this and update this as well. So do I have a motion to accept the committee's recommendation?
So moved.
So moved, second? Second, it's been moved and seconded that we accept the committee's recommendation to approve the proposed DC Bar Board of Governors policies and recommendations as found in attachment A in your materials. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Well, thank you, Chris. Thank you for your work on this and thanks for your leadership.
Thank you. Have a good afternoon.
Now we will turn to our report on the Client Security Fund. That's in tab A on your materials, which are proposed amendment to rule IG, is that IG, of the Client Security Fund Rules of Procedure. And Leah Nichols, who's on the screen, I think, will help walk us through that. Leah?
Hi, thank you very much. Thank you for hearing this issue. So I am one of the trustees of the DC Client Security Fund. If you're not familiar with it, the Client Security Fund is a really important way that the bar self-regulates and provides some compensation to those who have been subject to dishonest conduct by members of our bar. Every state has some kind of Client Security Fund. There is an ABA model rule about it as well. And essentially, if a lawyer engages in some kind of dishonest conduct and as a result, the client has lost money, and these aren't, I'll discuss this as we go along, not has paid the lawyer money or the lawyer has money that belongs to them. These are not consequential damages or anything like that. Then they are, we review claims for reimbursement to the client. The fund that we have is one that is funded by bar dues. So we all contribute to it as members of the DC bar. And it's here again to promote integrity of the bar and to provide some relief for clients of the bar who have been cheated essentially by their lawyers. So how the process works is a client files a claim for reimbursement with the fund. They have to demonstrate that they were a client or had a fiduciary relationship with a lawyer and show, for example, either that they have a settlement that the lawyer is holding and is not returning to them, or they paid fees that the lawyer did not earn and did not return to them, or something other. You know, when we talk about dishonest conduct here, we're not talking about it in the colloquial sense. It's really about something akin to theft or embezzlement and or keeping, otherwise keeping money that belongs to the client. It is a fund of last resort. One of the things the client has to show is that they have no other way to get the money back or to get the money in the first place if it was, say, a settlement. It is, if there is a fee dispute, they need to go through first, if appropriate, the attorney-client arbitration board. If that's available, they need to request those funds from the lawyer and either have gotten a refusal or a non-response. And then they can come to the fund after they've exhausted those other avenues, or if those other avenues aren't available or would be futile. What we see pretty frequently, I'll say just the kinds of claims that we see often unearned legal fees. Sometimes it's a part of a scam. For example, you'll see in the report and one of the footnotes, there's discussed a person who essentially held himself out as someone who could alter military records and would just take money and then not do the work. And we received a number of, I think we've had 25 claims involving this lawyer who has now been disbarred that we've been able to, you know, most of those, and one is pending, but we've been able to provide reimbursement for the fees that individuals paid to this now former lawyer, a member of the DC bar. So that's one of the common types of things that we see. We see sometimes, again, settlement monies that lawyers are not passing on to their clients. But one thing, and this is the reason for this rule, is that it's not obvious that when someone dies or becomes incapacitated, that that is dishonest conduct that can give rise to a reimbursable loss. Almost half, and this is in the report, of the claims that we've seen in this fiscal year have been in cases where a lawyer who had an active docket and active cases with clients had accepted initial fees and then passed away or became incapacitated before they could do any of the work or before they could complete the work. Now, normally when this happens, an individual will be appointed another lawyer to go through their files, find additional representation, and all of that. And if the person has, say, has a trust account, the unearned money can be returned to the client. But what we're seeing is not all the lawyers have these accounts, which they are required to have, or the accounts are insufficient to make all the reimbursements that they need to make. What is clear is that, you know, holding or converting the money that should be in the client trust account is dishonest conduct already under this rule. And so what we would propose, and please ask me any questions that you might have, what we would propose is a change in the rules that doesn't need to go to the Court of Appeals, but would just be a change in our rules to change the definition of dishonest conduct to include those circumstances in which a person can't complete the legal work for which they've already been paid because they have died or become incapacitated and they didn't have the money in a, you know, a separate account. So just to I do want to draw your attention to the specific, it is a proposed addition. It's on pages 5 to 6 of the report. So previously, dishonest conduct was defined to mean wrongful acts committed by a lawyer in the manner of defalcation or embezzlement of money, or the wrongful taking or conversion of money, property, or other things of value. The dishonest conduct need not have taken place within the District of Columbia in order for an application to the fund to be made or granted. That's the previous language. We have a proposed addition in between the two sentences that says dishonest conduct may include the failure to refund an unearned legal fee for the purposes of this rule if a lawyer dies or becomes incapacitated while representing the client, the lawyer's failure to properly safeguard the client's advanced unearned fees, rendering a refund unavailable to the client, may also be considered dishonest conduct. So this is making clear what we think is already the rule, but just making clear that it applies in a circumstance where the person was unable to complete the work because they were not able to do so. I will say what we also see is during this process, the lawyer or a representative of the lawyer gets an opportunity to provide a defense, to explain the situation or say, no, no, I did earn, you know, I did earn those fees, or to provide another explanation to counter the request for reimbursement by the client. And often what we do see is someone who, say they're represented by counsel, says, well, this person isn't able to do it because they're incapacitated. And that's not dishonest conduct. And while it's not dishonest conduct, failing to keep those unearned legal fees in a separate account that haven't been converted is. And so this is just to make very clear that that's the rule we're applying. So I'm happy to take any questions anyone has, or any clarification or anything else. I'm happy to take those.
Okay. Diane?
So I like the idea. The concern I have is you don't want to get a bunch of complaints from people who say, I, you know, didn't get my unearned legal feedback and it's been 3 days. You know, was there discussion about saying refund an unearned legal fee after the termination of the representation within X period of time? You know, because I know people have different ideas about when things end and that kind of stuff, but it just feels like it could make some very aggressive people, you know, disappointed that they're not getting their money back in 24 hours, which some people might want, you know.
And are you asking specifically in the context of someone's death or incapacitation?
No, I mean, just in general, if it's saying that you're not returning a fee, oh, and then I think there's probably other problems if someone dies and there's, you know, someone who has to get access to the bank account, do all that kind of stuff. Yeah. But just the run of the mill, you didn't return a legal fee that was unearned. I'd love to see a little more, again, just to maybe prevent some complaints and give people a minute to write the check or do the Venmo or whatever it is.
Sure. It's very clear in our rules. And, you know, if someone goes online and is looking to see where they qualify, that kind of thing, that it is a fund of last resort. And so we do, one of the questions that's in the form is, you know, have you asked for it back? And did they say no? Or they're non-responsive? And so that is one of the questions folks are asked. And we have excellent staff, of course, at the DC Bar. And when we get those claims, if it's too soon or that's not sufficiently clear, they'll follow up and we'll hold those in abeyance until they make other efforts to get refunded. We haven't seen, I would say, a huge number of those types of claims where, if any, or any that I can recall off the top of my head, where we're seeing people file claims virtually immediately. It's almost always a year later, 2 years later, they've called and they've emailed and they've not gotten a response. And that's when they come in and contact us. So point taken, but yes, they have to, before they can get anything from us, they must first ask for it from the lawyer if they're available. If it's a fee dispute, they do need to go through the attorney-client arbitration board, which is not available if someone is incapacitated or passed away. So it's a great question. You know, the staff at the bar screens those, and it hasn't been a huge problem.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Well, the Client Security Fund has proposed this amendment to Rule IG of the Client's Security Fund Rules of Procedures. Need a motion to accept that proposed amendment?
So moved.
It's been moved and seconded that we accept the proposed amendment to Rule IG, I.G of the Client Security Fund Rules of Procedure. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Leah. Thank you so much for the explanation and for your help on this.
Thank you very much.
Okay. I think that concludes our reports, except for our report from Bob and the year-end summary.
And this is going to be very brief. Yeah. You have in your materials a summary of the projects that we undertook during the course of the year, specifically in support of the strategic plan. We identify these at the beginning of every fiscal year to make sure that we are aligning what we do with your strategic plan. We tell you what they are up front. We report them on the mid-year. Of course, some of these you've been hearing about along the way as well. And once again, I'm very pleased to say that we have landed the plane on all of them, two of them almost, but there are works in progress. The DEIA task force report we expect in the fall, maybe at the September meeting, but definitely in the fall. And the pro bono center bylaws, which were due to be revised. They were pending a revision of the DC bar bylaws. They are under revision right now. We expect that to happen in the fall as well. Other than that, all of the rest of the projects that we took on, some of which were fairly technical, some were more programmatic, but we did, in fact, we did as you asked, and we got them done. Mm-hmm. So if anybody has any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, that is all for me.
Any comments, questions? Thank you, Bob, for that information and report. I think that we now will be moving into executive session for a couple items. And then if you guys can hang in here, we'll hopefully quickly finish and go to the rooftop, right, for our reception. Okay.